excuse me, Busted will be never made fun of on this channel because respect them musically. All okay. right, Air Hostess, I like the way you dress. I messed my pants flying over France. Lyrics like that don't come around too often. So I'm just gonna...
I mean, they're poets, really, aren't they? They are. More than the band.
Hello and welcome to the Spooktator podcast. I'm your host, Hayley Stevens, and joining me for this episode are Paul Gannon and Charlie Revel-Smith.
Hello.
Hello, I'm eating a cupcake.
You're eating a cupcake?
Mm.
Okay, thank you for letting us know. We're here to examine the stranger elements of life, society, international culture and the media. You can find details of everything we discuss in this episode at spooktator.co.uk, where you can also get in touch with us too. So, have you guys been up to anything interesting since we last spoke?
When did you last speak? A month ago, that was.
Yeah, a month ago.
I've been much the same, to be honest. I've been still working on my book, just pottering about with various projects. Nothing more, nothing less, really.
Oh, you failed to mention that you were involved in the London fireworks display,
Charlie.
Oh, yeah,
there was that as well.
I saw that on Twitter and my mind was blown.
Yes,
it was amazing.
It's just one of the many peculiar side jobs which I have managed to stumble into doing somehow. For the most part, what I'm actually doing is nothing to do with fireworks at all. I'm going around taking winds direction measurements. A lot of people right. might not know this, but there are, I think it's 4 or 5 different shows that can possibly go on at the London fireworks, depending on what the conditions are like. And they go from the A show, then you B show, C, depending on, it's mainly wind is the big problem about where the actual projectiles are going to be carried. So it's kind of, I like to think that I have a small but important role, and this is the 5th year I've done it, and every year they've fired the A show. Not because of me, I think it's just been fortunate luck, but there you go, a little behind the scenes knowledge.
That's really interesting. And no, that sounded really sarcastic. No, that is really interesting.
Yeah, it's a fun one day a year job that I do like to do.
So, Paul, have you been up to anything interesting?
Same old, really. I am just doing more cheap show and I'm doing more abortions and I'm working on a new project now called Digitizer, which is based off the old Teletext video games service, which will now be a YouTube series starting sometime before Easter.
Excellent.
Cool. Sounds pretty cool.
Yeah. I have an interesting, weird life and I work with odd people who do strange projects.
Am I right in thinking that this month was when the very last sort of remaining... like remnant of Teletext finally shut down?
Yeah, they switched it off, I think, a couple of weeks ago.
Yeah. It's the end of an era. That used to be...
It really is.
I used to absolutely love Teletext. I found it absolutely fascinating and just mind-blowing technology.
Well, back in our day, it was our internet, wasn't it?
Well, exactly, yes. I mean, it was the way in which... I mean, the fact that you could just type in a number and access a page online was just... Well, not online, but on Teletext... just mind-blowing. It was never seen anything like it before.
I say bring it back and get rid of the internet, frankly.
Yeah, it was much better back then.
It was much better then.
No, there were no podcasts.
Again, much better in the past.
Yeah, bring it back.
Mixed bag.
It's become apparent that we're gaining a lot of new listeners, which is great. Many people joined us for the last episode for the first time. The last episode obviously being one in which we spoke about having sex with ghosts.
Oh, I wonder why that was popular.
Yeah, I really hope that these listeners do stick with us and weren't just massively disappointed that it wasn't some sort of how-to.
It's not all sexy ghosts.
Yeah, like I could just, you know, maybe the title was misleading, I don't know. But hopefully you will stick around if you're listening and this is your second episode. Welcome to the show. Many people have been in touch with a story and I was hoping that we could kind of put the ghost sex behind us, but no. No, we cannot put the ghost sex behind us. Many people have sent us a link to a story that The Mirror have run, and the headline kind of sums it up perfectly, and it says, Woman fed up with searching for perfect man marries ghost of 300-year-old pirate. And then the subtitle says, Amanda Teague, 45, has married a Haitian pirate named Jack, who died in the 1700s, and the fact he's dead doesn't bother her.
Right.
Yeah.
I mean, does he know he's married to a living woman?
I mean, there are lots of questions that I have from
Yeah. First of all, the wedding ceremony must have took forever because they were using the Ouija board to do the vows. And when he does
Hang on, were they?
I don't know. I mean, I'm just presuming at this point. It's like the priest probably said, and if you do take Ms. Teague to be your awful wedded wife, please move the planchette to yes.
Or you could have had like a special designed one with an I do kind of button, speed things up.
That is a very good point. I didn't think about that. Custom made Ouija boards for all occasions.
Now, I'm imagining that this may not be 100% legally standing, this marriage.
No, really?
It was probably, officiated by some stoner. I don't know. I'm presuming so much right now.
I'm just reading the article again, and I completely missed the bit where it says, Amanda is a Jack Sparrow impersonator. Okay. Gets weirder and weirder. So basically, yeah, she says that she was fed up with searching for the perfect man, and so she married the ghost of a pirate who is her soulmate. Hey. Her friends and family attended the wedding on a boat off of the Irish coast. Like any ordinary couple, they have arguments, go on dates, and even have sex.
Right.
Amanda, a Captain Jack Sparrow impersonator, told the Daily Star, "He is my soulmate. I am so happy. It's the perfect kind of relationship for me. There are a lot of people out there who don't know about spiritual relationships, but it could be right for them. I want to get the message out there."
Is it just there's a trend of these stories, or is it just that men are so awful now that women are willing to sleep with
things imagined which don't exist?
Is that what it's got?
Well, I mean, you have to. I can kind of understand what these women are doing, and you know, because I hate to say it, guys, but sometimes men are really creepy, and at least with a ghost, you know what to expect. That's probably why women are kind of, you know, like monsters in movies, women kind of fall for monsters in movies. It's because with a monster or with a ghost, you know the worst that they can do. It's like, oh, you're a vampire. Okay, you might bite me. Oh, you're a werewolf. You're going to turn into a wolf one day of the month. Oh, you're a ghost. You're going to haunt the place. With a man, you're not quite sure.
I do think you underestimated the ferocious power of a werewolf and a vampire, though, somewhat.
Yeah, I think
You know, I watch Being Human. They managed most of the time.
I think that we might be overthinking it more than even she has, though, because I think this has got to just be somebody trying to make a bit of money on a story. Surely.
I don't know because there are photographs of her actually getting married on a boat in a wedding dress, and there are bridesmaids. The bridesmaids are all wearing bridesmaids dresses.
But who?
I don't know, guys.
Who was the best man? Was it
another pirate?
The Kraken? Did that just appear with the big ring behind the mast?
I think the clue is in the name there. A Kraken can't be the best man because he's not a man.
Yeah, but she's marrying a ghost. Why are we getting into the technicalities of all these details?
I know, that's true. I do like the idea, though, that there is a ghost, maybe a real ghost of this pirate going, hang on a minute. And he's just stood there on the boat going, no.
I mean,
I don't give my consent.
I think about the fight for marriage equality in this country and around the world, and people arguing about how this sort of marriage undermines marriage altogether. And I say, you look at the other stuff that's happening with marriage before you start pointing fingers.
The thing is, it might be a successful wedding and marriage because he won't be able to lie to her. You know why?
Why?
She can see right through him.
Ba-dum.
I thank you. That's all we need for this podcast. That's it. End it. Jeez. It's a high.
Good Lord.
Just the sadness in your voice then.
I should have seen that coming, really, but there we go.
There you go. I hate to plunder new depth with my humour, but I did.
Was that was a pirate
an
joke?
An attempt at a pirate joke there, wasn't it?
Yeah, sorry. I'm a shipwreck. Yeah. I really am.
I'm trying to get run-worked into something here, but no. I can't.
It's fine.
But seriously, though, welcome to the Spooktator if you only recently started listening. It's a pleasure to have you with us. If you do decide to go back and listen to the show from the beginning, it's completely your choice but not required, unless you want to know why I randomly shouted out about wanking monkeys in the last episode, in which case, yes, you will need to go back and listen to previous episodes. Or an alternative is to travel back in time, which actually might be easier than it seems.
Yes, because we were sent a story that... The thing is, these stories fascinate me. We're going to talk about time travel for the first segment of the show today. There was an article sent. Actually, it turned out that this article was presented on a few different websites. The one I'm looking at now is a bit more of an overview. It was in The Guardian, and it talks about the Woolwich Foot Tunnel and how, allegedly, when they were building it or doing maintenance on it, I think that was the right story, when they were doing maintenance of it, the basic gist of the story is a workman would go down into the tunnel. And the walk was meant to be, what, half an hour, 45 minutes, something like that. And then the guy would come up the other side. However, when he did, only a few minutes had passed, whereas for the man walking, the full 30 minutes was the time he experienced. So people started doing tests of, oh, well, let's give this man a flag and a rope, and we'll know when he gets to the other side, and blah, 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 blah. And they did all these tests, and to cut a very long story short, it suggested that this particular tunnel was one of many across London, which were portals, time portals throughout London, where time works differently. The Guardian article is interesting, though, because it takes a kind of overview of the story, and it talks to... a guy who runs the blog where the story was first shared called The Portals of London. And interestingly, the author, who wishes to remain anonymous, wanted to dispel the ambiguous nature of the project. He said a lot of people obviously don't believe in interdimensional portals, so they didn't think the stories were real, says the author. But they weren't sure if the person writing it thought it was real. So we had a lot of messages saying, I really like this, but where are you coming from? So the story is there, is that the story, the origin of the story is the mystery, not the story itself. Does that make sense?
The story itself is questionable.
And the website itself goes on to claim that it's working towards building a catalogue of London's interdimensional gateways. Via websites, via social media accounts, via the blog, all try to build this tapestry. Now, the first thing that came to my mind was, has someone read that Neil Gaiman book? Was it called Neverwhere? Yes.
Oh, yeah.
Because it has that sense of that to it. Because I think we all look at London and we think, oh, behind an alleyway, there might be a special missing portal to another world. You know, Neverwhere is a good example. Doctor Who's done it a few times.
Yeah. A door that opens up.
Diagon Alley, you know, from Harry Potter's. So it goes on to talk about the overall kind of a story of portals across the world and how they go back as far as Victorian times and how these stories crept from the real into the imaginary tales of Victorian ghost stories and M.R. James and all these kind of lovely, very ornate and spooky interwoven stories. But actually, at the end of the day, it doesn't say much. It is still an urban legend dressed up as a reader's account. And it's kind of like the Dear David thing, where we like it because the origin of the story or the storyteller is the mystery, not so much the details of the story.
I mean, just personally, as far as time travel is concerned, it's one of those topics that any film, any book, any TV show, anything dealing with time travel, I'm pretty much on board for it. I just find it just... The possibilities and everything are so exciting, and that I'm just there with time travel.
Yeah, I love it too. I'm fascinated with these stories because you in the back of your mind, you think, just one of them.
Yeah, just one. Just one person has come through either from the past or the future, and it means that the possibility is there suddenly. It would just be because it just having just a very basic understanding of science, you can just sort of think, well, it seems like science-y enough that it could be plausible until you do actually listen to the people who know what they are talking about in that kind of area, and it's like, nope, that's like an absolute impossibility that would ever happen. It's like, but I want it to be true so much. And there is something that I think London, especially, there is a certain sort of kind of gothic romanticism about certain mysteries which happen in London, which the idea of, like, yeah, they're being Victorian, like, secret time tunnels hidden underneath the streets. It's just a wonderful idea. But
I think it's almost born really from, like, Victorian London more than anything else, because Victorian London was more of a labyrinth than it probably is today. And so stories of Jack the Ripper and all these kind of Spring Hill Jack, where people would go missing and disappear around corners in the fog, it kind of gives that sense of London being in itself a labyrinth, a maze, a mystery. And all these kind of stories do is keep that kind of feeling alive in London, because I think London, after the bombing of the Second World War, lost a lot of its identity.
Yeah, and it's still... Mm-hmm. You can still see the evidence of what the bombing did to London. It never actually fully recovered afterwards.
Yeah.
No. But guess what? I mean, also, you can look at the tunnel itself in this story, the Woolwich Tunnel, as a metaphor for time travel, because tunnels lend themselves very easily to that. There's another story that, weirdly, I fell down to the rabbit hole of this whole thing, about another tunnel that was taking people back in time, and this one was in China. So, I'm going to read this story. This was from The Express, and I believe, 2016 the story was, actually, almost a year, 2 years ago to this day it was announced. I'll read it directly from the site. There's a tunnel in China that became the focus of an investigation after hundreds of people reported going back in time once they entered the 400-metre structure. Most people reported gaining an hour in time after continuing their drive outside the tunnel, as their mobile phones had gone back exactly 60 minutes. The phenomenon became so well known that one journalist working for the Evening News in, I want to say, Guiyang, so if I pronounce that wrong, unfortunately, I'm sorry, decided to carry out an experiment. So he drove through the tunnel at about a five-minute journey 10 times and reported gaining an hour on 8 of the trips. With no apparent explanation and the time gain baffling so many people, conspiracies and theories have abounded online, including everything from real time travel to alien abductions. Because that's the other bugger, isn't it? When you lose time, a lot of these stories either go, oh, it's an anomaly, or you've been attacked by aliens and taken on another ship.
You've lost time because you had your mind wiped because you were off somewhere else.
So yeah, that's another little story that's, again, fascinating. Again, people going, oh, they've lost time. I mean, the rest of the article doesn't really explain why this could be happening. It kind of takes the story as face value, which is frustrating, because if this is true, you'd kind of want a bit more than just hearsay. And then I went down another rabbit hole of time traveling, because there was, I couldn't find the link in time for this recording, but there's an article and a video of a kid who went to the year, I want to say 6,000 and something or other, and he came back and lost a friend there who decided to stay there because it was a utopia. But the kid was saying that effectively man and AI, artificial intelligence, were about to emerge, and the whole universe was run by artificial intelligence, or this whole, you know, the whole Earth was. And he brought back a picture of what the future looked like, and it was a little bit grainy and a bit fuzzy. That's a shame.
I honestly thought for a moment there that you were going to make a busted joke and say that he went to the year 3000 and not much had changed. They all lived underwater.
Excuse me, Busted will be never made fun of on this channel, because I respect them musically, all right? Air hostess, I like the way you dress. I messed my pants flying over France. Lyrics like that don't come around too often. So I'm just going to...
I mean, they're poets, really, aren't they? More than the band. Yeah.
And then there was the story I remember from years ago of a guy who was a plumber, and he was fixing a drain under a sink of someone's house.
I know this one. This one's brilliant.
Yeah, and he climbed through, and for some reason, like Narnia, underneath the sink in a cupboard, he was a time portal, which took him into the future, where he met himself as an older man, and he took a picture to prove it, and to be fair, they look very similar, and they have the same very horrible tattoo on their arm, and they're both bald, and that, for me, proved everything. But that's not even the tip of the iceberg. There are stories all over it. For people who want to follow the links to these stories, we'll put them on the website. But there's a website called Ranker.com. Ranker. Right. R-A-N-K-E-R. sometimes my soft Liverpoolian accent does confuse the R's and the W's. About mysterious time travellers with convincing stories. And they rank them. And there's an interesting one. There's two professors see Marie Antoinette in Versailles in 1901. Pilot sees futuristic plane. Journalist experiences air raids 11 years before they happened. The green children of Woolpit is a great story.
I've always liked that one.
I love that story.
That's a good one.
The story goes
that
they came out of like nowhere and claimed to be from somewhere else, and they were green.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's very strange, that story.
A policeman travels from the 1950s from 1996. I'm not sure, though, to be fair, if that isn't the plot from Goodnight Sweetheart.
Yeah, but I was
a little bit familiar, that one.
But that's a nice little story. Apparently, a man and his wife were shopping in London. They went to a bookshop. He got a CD down. He took off for a CD store down the street. While he was walking from the bookstore, he noticed that everything was suddenly quiet, and a van drove past that looked like the 1950s and honked and swerved at him, and everyone was wearing 1950s clothes. Confused, he went back to the bookstore, but it wasn't there. In its place with a woman's clothing store called Cripps. And then he, blah 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 blah, went back to the bookstore, found it, and found out that Cripps hadn't existed since the 1950s. And then there's a lot, we could go on the rabbit hole for ages talking about this, but the one I like the most is The Man from Torred. This has got to be quite a famous one. You've heard of this, right?
I don't know. I have.
No,
I'll condense the story down to its bare bones. But the story is, in 1954, is it? Yeah, 1954, a man got off a plane in Tokyo and had a problem getting through customs, because when they looked at his passport, it was from a country that didn't exist. And when they questioned him, he tried to explain where his country was on a map and was horrified to find it wasn't there. And then he started explaining his credentials. He had papers for a company that didn't exist, in a street that didn't exist, in a part of that ended up being, I think, Spain, where it was meant to be on the map. And he got very upset and confused, saying, "I don't know what's going on. I come from a place called Torred." He says that the location was right, but again, an expert said this place hadn't existed for 1,000 years or something like that. Anyway, they put him in a room to kind of get security and deal with it politically or whatever. And when they went back, he had vanished. So we never found that about the man from Torred. But anyway, loads of stories like that. And again, I think it appeals to that part of us that kind of wants to know what it's like to live in the past, or wants to have a taste of what the future's going to hold.
Yes, have a little peek around the curtain to see what the future holds. I mean, you go online and you do, if you have a search around for time travellers, essentially you get a bunch of, people who have found images of, like, olden day photographs of a guy who looks like Nicolas Cage or Keanu Reeves, and therefore they must be time travellers or vampires or something like that.
Yeah.
And there are also those photographs of people like in crowds, and they look like they've got phones or modern cameras.
Yeah, or
and
there is a
freak out about them.
There is a famous one of a guy with sort of like a kind of pair of hipster looking sunglasses on, and I think it was about sometime in the 1930s or something like that.
Yeah,
and people just
40s or 50s.
Yeah, maybe, but people just aren't aware that, oh, actually, you know what? There were occasionally people like to dress differently to everybody else in the past as well. It wasn't just
fashion
one uniform.
Comes around.
Yeah, fashion existed. Yeah, all of these things weren't just invented when you became aware of them. There was a lot.
No,
of fashion.
That's true. A lot of bloody hipsters looked like they were panning for gold in the gold rush period. You know what I mean? That's just the way life and fashion is. But I don't know. These stories fascinate me. And even though I hold no truck in the initial story that started this all off, again, it does appeal to that part of us that just wants to stretch the boundaries of where we might go. Because let's just put it this way. If you had a time machine and you went back even 10 years and you said, hey, in the future, Donald Trump's president of America, and you would be sectioned. And quite right too.
Yes.
Yep.
But then we can talk about the Mandela effect, I think, in a future episode, because we haven't touched on that, I don't think.
No.
And that's,
no, we
that's
haven't.
A left-hand step almost to these kind of stories. And on that note, I'm going to shut up about time travel, because it's wasting time.
What I liked about the story of the Woolwich Foot Tunnel was the fact, like the actual kind of details of it. So people didn't believe that it was actually happening, and they sent one guy down for it with a flag, and before he'd even gotten out of sight of someone who was watching him walk down the tunnel, they said they could see him on the other side of the river, and this guy is down there looking at his colleague who they say is now on the other side of the river, which is really, I thought was really quite cool. But a lot of people responded to that by saying, well, why didn't they film it, why didn't they take photographs and so on?
Exactly.
if they did though, would you believe it?
No,
I don't know. But
I mean, the thing is, I don't think there is any photographic or video evidence that would convince people, because everyone would just say, oh, well, it's faked footage. So
exactly. And that I find people respond to that. Skeptics particularly say that a lot. They're like, well, why didn't you film it when you saw this Bigfoot creature? Why didn't you take a photograph when you saw this ghost? Why weren't you filming it? And I'm not really sure why they say that, because if there was evidence produced, if there was footage filmed of this guy walking down the tunnel and then people on the shore are saying, oh, I can see him on the other side, and they filmed that, we wouldn't believe it. It's a weird response.
Yeah, what evidence, what photographic or otherwise evidence would it take for you to believe in, you know, 100% that this UFO or this ghost or this lake monster is real? I don't think there is such a thing, because it is just assumed that no matter how good it is, there is still the possibility that it was faked. So
yeah,
I mean, yeah, imagine Back to the Future. You know, Doc Brown gets the film, the VHS camera out to film the experiment and the time difference on the watch that the dog has and his watch. Again, you get people saying, oh, that's a magic trick, that. You get, everyone could change a watch.
You do know that wasn't real, don't you?
Shut up. My reality is very fragile. If you're telling me Back to the Future is not a documentary, they're going to have a problem.
I can remember growing up, obviously I live in Wiltshire, I've grown up in Wiltshire, and very close to home in Avebury, where you've got the stone circles, there's a very famous time slip or time travel story there, where motorists, I think more than one person has reported it, they'll be driving along the road, and as they come over the kind of the hill into Avebury, they look across into the stone circle and they see like a medieval reenactment happening. And when people have checked in to see what was happening and, you know, what the event was about, they find that there was no event there. But numerous eyewitnesses have reported seeing like a fair with people in period dress in the stones. So a lot of people now, obviously people travel to Avebury and the area around it, because it's you know, a site of wonder and everything. But a lot of people travel there to see if they can experience the paranormal things themselves. There's another story about a stone, like, you know, this huge stone that weighs tons, apparently jumps across the road. And it's said that you can see fairies and people and other kind of elemental creatures there. But yeah, a lot of people now travel to Avebury to see if they can experience the time slip themselves, which is quite cool.
Yes, well, on that subject of tourism, for this episode, I decided I wanted to talk about something that was a bit different, only different because it's not connected to any recent news events at all. In fact, the only reason it came to mind was because I just happened to remember reading an article about some attempts to get a Yorkshire Ripper walking tour off the ground.
Oh, my God.
Along the lines of the... Yes, along the lines of the Jack the Ripper walking tours, which have been going on for pretty much since the days of Jack the Ripper. In fact, I think the first ever Jack the Ripper walking tour was reported in around about Christmas of 1888. So about a month after what we believe was the final Jack the Ripper murder happened.
Are you serious?
Yeah. Now, the term that's applied to this, going in search of murder sites of atrocity, is called dark tourism. It's, you know, exactly as it sounds. And for instance, the very popular Jack the Ripper walking tours, and in fact, much of Whitechapel in East London is promotes itself on the back of Jack the Ripper. And I think it was back in 2014, there was a huge controversy when there was a Jack the Ripper museum open in the East End. But there are lots of other examples in the UK, such as the town of Hungerford in Berkshire, which has for a long time had a huge problem with people visiting solely because they want to meet and talk to the locals who were there on the day that there was a huge gun massacre, one of the largest that the UK has ever seen, back in 1987. And there's Saddleworth Moor, which is best known for being the scene of the Moors murders, where they bury their
classy
victims. And in fact, now I've heard tales, and I honestly don't know how true they are, but I never underestimate people's ability to behave in poor taste. But stories of couples recreating the Brady Hindley photographs of themselves on the
mall. You know, I'm surprised they haven't done a frickin' bloody charity find the glove competition, you know, and just do that kind of
thing. Yes! Because people are terrible. This is, but in recent decades, people have actually tried to curb some of this dark tourism because it can be very upsetting for people living nearby. So there was, like, very famously, Fred and Rose West's house was torn down, as was the primary school gymnasium in Dunblane. And I think there was few people would argue that this wasn't a sensible thing to do, considering it's so recent and it's so raw in people's minds. But I do have to admit or confess to something of a taste for dark tourism myself. Whenever I have friends come to stay in Bristol, I like to take them to the M-Shed Museum, which is kind of like a history of Bristol museum here, and show them the skin book, which is literally what it sounds. It's a book of trial notes of a murderer called John Horwood. And after he was executed, they leathered his skin and bound his trial notes in it. And you're going to go and see it in the museum. And I love historic graveyards, you know, especially the kind of overgrown Victorian Gothic kind of ones.
Well, Highgate Cemetery is probably like the best example of it, isn't it?
Highgate is the... Highgate is the kind of the king of historic cemeteries. Although, never underestimate Arnus Vale here in Bristol, which is from around about the same age. Beautiful one.
It's stunning. I love Arnus Vale so much.
Yeah, it's such a fantastic day out. I love the fact it has actually kind of started promoting itself as a tourist destination.
Yes.
They do kinds of things. They're quite involved in this society called the Good Grief Foundation.
Yeah.
God.
Exactly as you would think it is, where it does lots of things about dealing with mortality and things like that. But they also do things like Pilates courses among the gravestones and things like that.
And they do bat watches. You can
bat
go
watches,
and,
yes.
And
they screen films in the cemetery. I think they have actually really fully embraced themselves as a tourist destination for kind of like macabre edge to it, but I think they've done it in a really tasteful way.
Yeah, I agree. I think it's really lovely. But what I always found weird whenever I went there was the fact that you can go into the cafe and you can have like cake and a cup of tea, and then you can go downstairs in the cafe and they've got the old crematorium machine
there.
So you're literally sat above the crematorium machine eating your cake and
your tea. Is quite a strange thing to think of when you do that. I've actually been on a couple of the Jack the Ripper walking tours, which themselves are becoming more and more controversial. And in fact, I think that we're going to start seeing them phased out in the future, because a lot of the walking tours are, a lot of the guides are realizing that they are, a lot of people are sort of confronting them on these tours about, what are you doing? Why are you doing this? But anyway, the first of these tours that I did was back in 2010, and it was guided by Lindsay Savita, who's a very highly regarded historian. And I actually found it really interesting. It was respectful and tasteful. It put the victims at the heart of the story. But the one I went on last year was absolutely abysmal. And for some reason, the guide had thought that he would inject humour into the tour, and just felt really tasteless. And I don't think it was just me who felt really, really uncomfortable with it. And now there's actually lots of people have argued that the walking tours are exploitative, or that they're in bad taste. And it's kind of hard to argue against that kind of thing. When it's a question of personal ethics, it's sort of, where do you draw the line?
But the thing is, for me, it's like, what part of it is exploitation, and what part of it is keeping this part of history alive, because it is, for better or for worse, an important story. I mean, Jack the Ripper is an incredibly important story, regardless of whether you believe X, Y, or Z committed it, or whether it was eight people who did all these murders, or there were copycats. Mm-hmm. It's still a fascinating thing about how this was possibly the first ever sensationalised murder in the UK, in terms of how the tabloids dealt with it and all these kind of things. It was the birth of maybe sensationalist crime journalism. But how would you tell that without, you know, offending? I mean, here's the other thing as well. There's a thing that people talk about called the less dead. And these are people who, when they die, no one cares, because they were either homeless, or they were, you know, sex workers. So people would argue that these women who were killed during the Jack the Ripper murders were the less dead because of their profession, because of their background, because of whatever they want to use to excuse it.
Yeah.
If you're treating it that way, is that not in itself offensive? Is the problem of treating these people like footnotes to the overall mystery? Or is it important that we speak to them as humans so you get a better idea of why these stories need to be kept being told?
Yes. I mean, there is a degree to which the Jack the Ripper story will always be fascinating. It's a period of history. People love Victorian London generally. But the kind of the first commonly recognised serial killer, all the stuff about the conditions of the East End at the time, it's all incredibly evocative. All the gas lights and, you know, the London fogs, all of that is inescapable. It's a matter of where you draw the line. And I think time is a big factor in with that as well. And that's why we sort of balk at the idea of a Yorkshire Ripper walking tour as being so incredibly offensive. I think time is a big component there.
I agree with how the context in which these things are done is important. So, as you said, Paul, you know, the opposite of not doing the tours is to not remember what happened. I think it's about doing so tastefully. So, Charlie, you mentioned the first tour you went on was tasteful and the second one wasn't.
Yeah.
And the museum that you mentioned, the Jack the Ripper Museum that opened, was it 2014?
I think it was around. It had quite a prolonged opening because they wanted to open on a certain date, but there were so many protests about it that it sort of, they kind of invited the guests, like the press in and things on one day and things like that. So it's not, it was opened over several months to
the end. Well, the reason there was such a backlash with that museum is because they billed themselves as a celebration of London women, you know, the suffragette.
Yeah, it was going to be a working women museum for like the history of women working.
And then it opened as a Jack the Ripper.
I mean, they literally, by all accounts, they literally, it was when the sign went up outside, they might as well have like pulled the curtain out the way and said, here's what it really
Surprise!
Is.
Surprise!
And that's what people found so astonishingly important.
The other problem is like,
about it.
Where do we draw the line between outrage for outrage's sake and outrage because obviously something has crossed the line? Like the sensationalism of a story is one point, but then telling the story in itself is not exploitation in itself. It's like one of the most popular genres of podcasts right now is true crime, murder podcasts, and they are huge.
Yeah.
So many, and obviously Serial was a big reason for that. I always go on about Last Podcast on the Left, and even though it's meticulously researched, it also can be quite, you know, exploitative and quite broad and shock jockey. So it's got this weird balance to it. But you look at what the stories they tell.
Yeah.
And not only is it like just supernatural, or whatever, but also Albert Fish, H.H. Holmes. You've got people like that. You've got, you know, Bundy. People are fascinated with the darkness inherent within human people because I think there's a certain amount of distance that we like to put between ourselves and the people who commit these crimes. So we like to demonize.
But it's more than that, I think. I think one of the most well-known murder podcasts is My Favourite Murder. And I find that podcast interesting because it kind of touches upon the dark side of human nature and, you know, the fact that really are any of us truly safe in our homes, but also what I find My Favorite Murder does really well is the fact that they kind of explore the vulnerability of the victims and, you know, what happened to them and how they were let down.
They never lose sight of that there is a tragedy at the heart of.
And I think as a young woman myself, you know, whenever I go out on my own, I always have my house keys between my knuckles and I'm always, you know, because obviously I live in quite, not a remote area, but, you know, there are streets where there are no street lights and there's a field that I have to walk across if I want to go to a certain area. And so you do always plan ahead about how you can keep yourself safe. And I think that's probably something that men also experience to a point, but not as often as women do. And so these podcasts now, I think especially for women, they're a way for us all to go, yes, we also feel like this. And this is justified.
Yes. There's something empowering about.
Yeah.
And yet though, I wonder why. And again, this is my opinion, this is nothing based on research, whatever, but My Favourite Murder is specifically very popular with a female audience. And I think, and again, I am guessing here, so I could be completely wrong, I would say a lot of people who listen to true crime podcasts are probably mostly female audiences. And I don't know...
Apparently that is true of just true crime in general. It has been as far as books are concerned and things like that. And there's lots of people have written articles about why it could possibly be. But I think it might be a case of it being just the fact that women are so much more frequently victims of random sporadic violence, that there could be something perhaps, and obviously Hayley, you'd be better answering this, but there would be something that's potentially empowering about actually knowing and understanding what the world can be like.
I think all girls grow up, when you become a teenager, you start to recognize that the world is potentially a dangerous place for you, and that the statistics are skewed, that there is a chance that you're going to be attacked at some point because of your gender. And so when you read true crime books, or you listen to true crime podcasts, or you watch television shows, it's almost like it's not just in your head, it's real. And it's because you do feel like you're paranoid when you're walking through a car park with your keys. When I call it doing a Wolverine, and when you're doing that, you feel, you think to yourself, am I not just thinking the worst of the people around me? But then you listen to My Favourite Murder, or you watch one of these documentaries, you know, the crappy documentaries on YouTube, and it does happen to people. And it's like it's your fears are being acknowledged, and also you can kind of learn about the ways and to spot potential problems. And what would I do if I was in that situation? What did they do? How did they survive? How did they not survive? And I don't know. But
I think to take it back to the dark tourism thing, it's like there seems to be an unhealthy fixation with dark tourism to basically give people safe danger, if that's not too much of an oxymoron. Yeah. So
it's a ghost train.
It's a ghost. Yeah. So when people, like, again, you watch this on so many paranormal reality TV shows where they go to a haunted house that has a poltergeist that was, you know, in life that person was a murderer or a rapist or a serial killer or something horrible. And they challenge it. They want that sickness. They want that demonic interaction because it's dramatic, but also because at the back of their mind, they know they are safe. And it's playing with that. Yeah. And I think when people, by and large, go on a ghost hunt, one of these tourism ghost hunts, or, you know, a dark tourism thing, they want the sensation of being in danger, and they want that threat, and they want to be a victim of that danger. But then they also know at 2 o'clock in the morning, they get to go home safe and sleep in their nice warm beds, and then they literally turn that off. And so there's an unhealthy amount of exploitation of horrible, real events.
Yeah. I think it's probably also that I would imagine something else that plays a role in this is the fact that, you know, these crimes and these things that happen are so terrible that it's almost inhuman. And I suspect that we have a fascination with things that go wrong. So, you know, a woman who kills her children, or, you know, it's not normal. For example, in the case of Fred and Rose West, it's not normal to have people buried under your floor and to kill them in your home. And so it's like an outsider thing. So that's an outsider thing. And I think perhaps maybe there's some kind of fascination with that, because we all want to be healthy and normal. And it's just fascinating that these people go wrong and they act in ways that are not acceptable.
What caused them to break? What was the...
Exactly.
I remember a few months ago in Chicago, I was in the area called Boys Town, which is where John Wayne Gacy was killing how many people. And I was there with a friend who went past the shop, and he said to me, "Did you know there was a genuine painting in that shop by John Wayne Gacy?" I was like, "Well, we are going in. We have to see it." And we did go and see it. And of course, the man being the man, it was a painting of Adolf Hitler.
It's not
for sale in the shop. It is actually, it's just sort of like, I mean, this shop is kind of, it's all kinds of things you can buy. You can buy human skulls and all kinds of things like that in this place. But this, seeing this thing on the wall, it was impressive, not as a piece of art, but it was impressive in as much as this is almost a way of, like you said, safely experiencing that kind of darkness at a removed distance where you are safe. Yeah. But talking of skulls, I remember a few years ago in Paris going into the catacombs, yes, which is another dark tourist destination. And I was there really early on in the day, and there was only a few people ahead of me. And by the time I got out, he searched through my bag, and I was said to the guy, people don't steal bones from here, do they? And he showed me the bag which he had there just of people who had taken bones in the first hour of being open. God, and it was just a bag full of skulls that people
oh
had.
Oh my God.
So yeah, that I think everybody would say that is bad dark tourism. That is
actually. Oh my
actually
God, that's how you get cursed.
Exactly.
You deserve to be cursed if you steal someone's
yes.
skull.
No. Yeah.
But at least if you go to the Haunted Mansion afterwards, you can go to the gift shop and buy a nice glow in the dark
exactly,
bone.
Exactly, yes.
Yeah, yeah. Good Lord, yes. That's awful. What but, are people doing with them? Are they literally just drinking wine out of them or something?
I have no idea what they're doing. I guess it's just you go and stick it on your desk.
There are not that many amateur dramatic societies putting on Hamlet.
Yes.
You mentioned earlier about how the house of Fred and Rose West was pulled down and so on. But unfortunately, it doesn't stop people from going to the street where the house was. People do go, there's like a little kind of garden.
Yes, they've
thing
tried to
there.
Make it as like uneventful a place as you can imagine, like nondescript yeah. kind of a area.
But it still attracts tourists. Yeah. They all go down there and people sometimes try and take like stones and stuff. Yeah.
I think they made sure they didn't put any benches in there or anything like that. Nothing to actually have people hanging around. I think it's just like a sort of footway taking you from one road to another.
And also though, it's like Paul said though, there's distance, there's time, there's a long stretch of time between us today and that happening. Whereas a lot more of them kind of more recent tragedies that people kind of flock to, it's still kind of a rawness there. And one of the ones actually that's come to mind is in 2010, when there was the Northumbria manhunt for Raoul Moat.
Oh, yes, of course. Yes.
And whilst that was still happening, while the police were surrounding that little village that he was holed up in somewhere, that, you know, it was still an active manhunt and people were flocking to it then and they still go there now.
Yeah, he practically had cheerleaders at one point.
He did.
It was...
Yeah.
It was such a dark moment in Britain for so many reasons, that whole strange week or so was.
But also, what kind of struck me about the Raoul Moat thing was the fact that the press had a huge role to play in that, in the way that they were also very invasive and they kind of got in the way and they kind of, you know, the police were trying to deal with this situation and the press were trespassing and causing issues. And I wonder if the fact that the press has become so invasive, you know, we've got this 24-hour news coverage now, the channels have got to fill their news feeds with constant stuff so you get live streams from events as they're happening. I wonder if that has kind of made it more acceptable for us to go on these sorts of dark tourist tours and to these attractions and stuff because we see it on the news and it kind of desensitizes us to it. I'm just...
But also, we've made these stories ephemeral because the way news works now is that today's hot story is tomorrow's chip paper. That whole adage, you know? So, someone could be murdered horribly, horribly today, but a week from now, there's some other tragedy or Boris Johnson said something else that's dumb. And ultimately, those stories get lost. And so I think people are always chasing the next big thing. And, you know, for want of a better phrase, there's no real post-mortem anymore.
So for this episode, I want to talk about a book that I've just finished reading. I don't want to turn the podcast into a book club, but this book is really worth mentioning, I think. It's called Ghost of the Tsunami by Richard Lloyd Parry. And it's about the tsunami which devastated the coast of northeast Japan in March 2011. It was much more powerful than a lot of people had ever experienced before and caused mass devastation. Now, on this podcast, we've spoken about the ghosts seen in the areas affected by the tsunami before in previous episodes, when I think there was a story about a researcher who was interviewing taxi drivers in the region. I don't know if you guys remember that. The researcher found that a number of taxi drivers reported picking up what we in the West would call phantom hitchhikers, yeah, who asked to be taken to places which no longer existed because they'd been destroyed by the tsunami waters. And the taxi drivers reported that the passenger would disappear halfway through the journey, much like our hitchhikers do here, our phantom hitchhikers do here. This book, Ghosts of the Tsunami, pays particular focus to Okawa Primary School, where over 70 children perished when the tsunami reached their playground, to which they had evacuated after the initial tremors, which caused the tsunami. There was a lot of mystery around why the teachers had not evacuated the children up a steep hill behind the school where the waters would not have reached them. And this book is an absolutely devastating read, and I cried every time I picked up to read it. I actually had to stop reading it halfway through because it was so emotional. Basically, the author lives in Japan and experienced the earthquakes for himself, but didn't experience the tsunami. But because he was in the area, he visited the places that did experience it. And basically, this is his reporting on the people that he spoke to. And it's a must read, I think. I bought it a few days before my mum died. And I think that's probably why it was quite difficult for me to read, because the rawness of the grief and the anger of the people in the book is really clear and quite palpable. Now, obviously, the reason I bought this book was because it talks about ghosts, and specifically Ghosts of the Tsunami, which we've covered before. So I was interested. I wasn't expecting it to be so hard-hitting. There wasn't as much discussion of ghosts as I'd initially thought. However, there are indeed ghosts that haunted those areas. And in this book, Parry writes, and I quote, this is him talking about the people who've told him about the things they've seen. I quote, they described sightings of ghostly strangers, friends and neighbours, and dead loved ones. They reported hauntings at home, at work, in offices and public places, on the beaches and in the ruined towns. The experiences range from eerie dreams and feelings of vague unease to cases like that of outright possession. There was one story that he shares in here. I'm not going to just read the pages because you should go and buy it and read it yourselves. But there was one story in here which I thought was quite interesting and touching. Basically, a fire station in Tahajo received calls to places where all the houses had been destroyed by the tsunami. The crews went out to the ruins anyway, prayed for the spirits of those who had died, and the ghostly calls ceased. A taxi in the city of Sendai picked up a sad-faced man who asked to be taken to an address that no longer existed. Halfway through the journey, the driver looked into his mirror to see that the rear seat was empty. He drove on anyway, stopped in front of the levelled foundations of a destroyed house, and politely opened the door to allow the invisible passenger out at his former home. And there was one other story in here which kind of I found quite funny. And it was about this old neighbour who would appear in the living rooms of the temporary houses that refugees were housed in. And this neighbour would sit down for a cup of tea with the occupants, and no one had the heart to tell her that she was dead. And I thought that was quite cute.
Does the book touch on something which I heard about on, I think it was an episode of This American Life, about, I think it's called the Wind Telephone, which was, it was a public telephone box in which word spread that you could hear the voices of people who, you could speak to people who had died through this telephone, and the whole story just sounded absolutely devastating.
So what, they would call, or the thing would ring and people would pick up and hear?
I think that you would just, I mean, they weren't hearing anything as far as I know, but it was just, the idea was that you wouldn't even hear a voice, but you could speak to somebody, which is heartbreaking about it.
Because so it was all symbolic.
Especially that men in Japanese society were not expected to be very emotionally articulate in any way, and they were often supposed to keep it all bottled up. So it was almost exclusively men who were going and using this telephone, which was just a regular telephone box. There was nothing that was unusual about it anywhere at all, but it was just this word spread that you could talk to your loved one and they would be able to hear you at the end of the phone. And it was, the whole thing was just heartbreaking to listen to.
What I found most interesting as I read this book was how it forced me to think about ghosts and the way they're experienced outside of the context of our culture. Obviously, that's something we've spoken a lot about how ghosts of different cultures influence modern day sightings and so on. But regarding the ghosts of the tsunami, I never considered the fact that for the survivors, it was almost like they had a double layered loss in, because in their culture, not only did they lose those killed by the tsunami, who they then believed wandered as unrested spirits, but they also had to contend with the belief that the spirits of their already deceased ancestors were now unrestful. Because in their culture, ancestor worship is a tradition, and many homes have shrines or altars to the dead, which they lay the memorial tablets on, and they display photographs and food and drinks and gifts, and they say prayers, and rituals are undertaken to acknowledge and remember their ancestors. When there are important matters to be decided, they speak to the ancestors at these altars and so on. And the tsunami, in the book, Parry writes, the tsunami did appalling violence to the religion of the ancestors. And by that he means that not only did the waters wash away homes, buildings, villages and people, but it also washed away and destroyed their altars and memorial tablets and shrines. Oh, cool. And the cemeteries were destroyed, yeah. And the bones of those that were buried there were scattered around, and many of them weren't put to rest again. And a priest told the author of this book that when there's a disaster where you and I might grab our important documents and get out and run for our lives, many people will rescue the memorial tablets of their ancestors because that's how important they are. And went on to point out that a lot of people would have died in the tsunami because they rushed towards the danger to save the memorial tablets at home, which completely blew my mind. I'd never really considered that before. And something which kind of resonates with what you were discussing, Charlie, is how after the tsunami, and during the kind of the recovery process, teenagers would dare one another to make nighttime visits to the ruins of the primary school where these children had died. And some of these parents at the time still hadn't recovered the bodies of their children. And the book also discusses how the communities which had been impacted by the tsunami were torn over whether the ruins left behind should be preserved or destroyed. It was pointed out that people had died in those places. Their remains had not been found, so it would be disrespectful. But others argued that the sites would act as a vital reminder of what had happened and would inspire hope. But either way, the book really brings home something that I think we discuss a lot, which is the need that people have for ghosts and the important role they play for the bereaved. And I would encourage everyone listening to get a copy of this book and read it, because the way it's written and the way the stories of these people are told really, really cements the importance of this, which, you know, we should all keep at the forefront of our minds when dealing with the bereaved who see ghosts. But do be warned, because it will just make you cry like a baby. I cried so much. It was ridiculous.
I do hope that at least on this podcast that we try and be respectful of people's beliefs, because ghosts, especially, I think more so than belief in aliens or Bigfoot or whatever you want it to be, there is often a real need for it, for people, for it to be true, that they have invested so much of their hope on this being true, that it isn't something that we should ever just laugh off and think these people are idiots or anything like that. And I hope that we don't ever come across like that.
Yeah, it's. I think we're more interested in the kind of one of a better phrase, the standards and practices of like how this industry is talked about.
Yes.
And it's hard for you to take someone's belief away in the same way that I would presume they wouldn't want to talk about a skeptic's belief system or moral code. It just comes down to the fact that I think I've mentioned this once or twice, but I definitely talked about it in my solo show. You know, when I started doing the ghost hunting thing for research for that show, there was a woman on a ghost hunt at some fort. I can't remember where it was now. And she was really interested. She'd never been on a thing like this before. She was asking all these interesting salient questions about the technology and the science, quote unquote, of ghosts and ghost hunting. And when I caught her outside having a smoke with some friends, she was only on that ghost hunt because her husband was near death, and she wanted to know that there was something there for him when he died.
Yeah.
And so there was that sense of, at that point, it's not for me to turn around and do a smug gag about her belief in the afterlife, you know, because everyone has to process it differently. You could argue it only when it becomes unhealthy or when it becomes dangerous to them or people close to them that you need to step in. But until then, look, it's fundamentally harmless. Yeah.
And it's also the people who are exploiting grieving people as well. When you have people who are trying to con people out of money and things like this to, you know, make a quick profit themselves, then that is very dubious.
And I think also the notion of stepping in as well is important, but it's also something that's very complex because how you step in isn't always clear cut. Sometimes it's not your place to step in. And it could be unethical for you to step in. It's a really difficult call to make. And obviously, I get people who contact me all the time, not all the time, but quite often people get in touch with me to say, I've had this strange experience, or I've taken this strange photograph. Could this be the ghost of my dad or my brother or whatever? Every single time I have to question how I kind of respond to that, because I don't want to be the asshole who says, no, it's not the ghost that you really, really need. So I think as people who, whether we're kind of casual skeptics who tweet or we speak at events or we produce podcasts, I think we have to be so careful about how we talk about these things, because ultimately we have to be on the side of the people who believe. Because usually that belief is, you know, there's a reason behind it. So this has been another episode of The Spooktator. Paul, where can people find you?
I'm on Twitter. You can find me at Paul Gannon Show. And if you want a podcast from me that is a little bit more risque, then I have a show called Cheap Show that you can find us on thecheapshow.co.uk, or just look for Cheap Show, one word, on any good podcasting app, iTunes, Stitcher, the works. You'll find it. I'm just going to apologise in advance if you listen to it.
And Charlie, where can people
find me, as always, on at Weird Bristol on Twitter, where I talk about unusual Bristol history. And this month, in a few days from now, usually round about the 22nd, I shall be appearing on the Famous Five podcast, which is a book where they talk about a different Famous Five book each episode. And I will be talking about book 7, Five Go Off on a Camp.
Yay!
Okay. I love the fact that we are such a weird bunch of people.
We do such strange things in the science.
I don't say weird as a bad thing. I think that's awesome.
Eclectic.
That's no, I agree.
Yeah. And as always, you can find me at my blog, hayleyisaghost.co.uk, but I'm not a ghost. You can find all of the links to the things we've discussed at spooktator.co.uk, where you're also able to get in touch with us if you want to, and you can find all of the subscription links too. Please consider leaving a review for the podcast to help other people find us, and thank you to all of those who have already done so. We'll be back with Season 2, Episode 2 in February. Until then, remember, spooky is in the eye of the beholder.